chapter 23, and we'll start in again on the series of the things Jesus said on the cross. And today, the second of those things, today you will be with me in paradise. You'll find it in Luke chapter 23 and verse 43. We'll read the passage and the setting of it, but before we do that, I'd like to read you several stanzas from a hymn that most people associate with a statement. It's a hymn entitled At Calvary, and you'll recognize it as soon as the first stanza is read. Years I spent in vanity and pride, caring not my Lord was crucified, knowing not it was for me he died on Calvary. By God's word at last my sin I learned. Then I trembled at the law I'd spurned, till my guilty soul imploring turned to Calvary. Now I've given to Jesus everything. Now I gladly own him as my king. Now my raptured soul can only sing of Calvary. Oh, the love that drew salvation's plan. Oh, the grace that brought it down to man. Oh, the mighty gulf that God did span at Calvary. And you know the refrain. Mercy there was great, and grace was free. Pardon there was multiplied to me. There my burdened soul found liberty at Calvary. It reminds us of the scene found in Luke chapter 23, in which in the setting of all those who were mocking and calling out to Jesus, there is a single conversion. You get close when a centurion exclaims, truly this was a Son of God upon the death of Jesus. But in the circumstance of his suffering, this is the one lone narrative in which you have a conversion experience. Somebody who gets it at the final moment, at the most humiliating moment, in the greatest set of contrary circumstances, somebody gets it. Most of us get it when we see Jesus getting his way, when he answers prayer, when things go our way, when we know God is alive and he cares for us. All that we usually play on to encourage us. Here's a story of a man who gets it when he realizes that nothing is going his way and nothing seems to be going Jesus' way either. It is a remarkable narrative in light of that. So let's read together. Would somebody read aloud for us verses 39 through 43 of Luke chapter 23. I like that expression, malefactor. He was a criminal. Somebody who was, as by his own admission, rightfully put in this place. Remember, crucifixion was a rather common way of dealing out capital punishment under Roman rule. Anyone who practiced an activity that denied the benevolence and wonder of the Roman Empire was liable to crucifixion. That is, if you stole things, if you were a criminal, a thief, a robber, you were as liable as anyone who was a political insurrectionist and found guilty of acts of sedition or treachery or treason. So that's why you have people who were common criminals crucified along with someone who was regarded as such a great threat to the internal stability of this land, that is Jesus. You have them crucified along with each other, and you'll remember that only Luke's narrative has the scene of this man's conversion. All the other Gospels mention that there were two crucified along with Jesus, mention that they were criminals, imply that they were due this punishment for their crime under Roman law, but only Luke has the scene in which one of them is involved in a breakthrough, a moment of awareness. Now, in Luke's Gospel, it's important to remember how Jesus is presented. This is another scene in a string of scenes in which Jesus willingly is numbered or associated with those who are regarded as sinners. Now, the notion of a sinner, I know for most of us, is people who do bad things. And since you don't do bad things, you're not in the same category. But sinner in Luke's Gospel is a very different category. Sinner is anyone who is regarded as outside the daily practice of Jewish piety. It would include everybody from people who did evil things, things that you wouldn't want to be named or associated with, to people who were simply too poor to practice the piety of everyday Judaism. It would have involved people who had mixed birth, that is, who wouldn't have been involved or regarded as sort of pure breeds. Those of you who spend any time in the assemblies realize that on occasion we have a problem with this purebred idea, whether or not you were raised in an assembly or whether your parents were in an assembly or whether you're a latecomer to the movement. And you think, oh, that's rather trivial and funny. But within the practice of everyday Judaism, your ability to say that you are, let's say, if you're a first-generation practitioner of Judaism around Jerusalem, you would be regarded as a little lower. So that if you had a legacy, a family, where your grandfather was infamous in starting a synagogue, maybe in a certain region, well, then you would have a pedigree. And you would have been included with the very rigorous of those who kept the law of daily piety around Jerusalem. You would have been regarded as what we would call a second-class citizen. And on occasion, to the very strenuous around Jerusalem, you might have even fallen into the category of sinner. What it is really is a social category. It's not simply people who do things wrong, but it's a category into which people are assigned if they don't measure up to your high standards of practicing Judaism. So it's a little broader than the category we usually use when we say someone is a sinner. It usually means somebody who has the social stigma. And this is a large category of people. And it's based on the notion that there is a rigorous practice of piety, sort of a legalism associated with the daily life of Judaism around the temple area. And Jesus is willingly numbered with people who are within that category. He eats with tax gatherers and sinners. He enters the house of and enjoys the company of and receives the worship of and provides miracles on behalf of, in Luke's gospel, those who are regarded as part of the larger population. You remember, Luke's gospel is the gospel that doesn't end Jesus' genealogy by going back to Abraham, but pushes it all the way back to the story of Adam. And in the biblical narrative, that would be Jesus' association through his genealogy with not simply the legacy, the genetic legacy of someone like Abraham, but the genetic legacy of everyone. In Luke's gospel, he also associates not only with the category of sinners and with the nations of the world, but he is the one who emphasizes in Luke's gospel that he has come to bring salvation to those who are regarded as lost. So that if you want to know where Jesus is, where he is active, and what kind of influence he has, he wishes to exert influence or to be known or to be recognized among those who are regarded as lost. So he says upon meeting Zacchaeus and entering into his house, salvation has come to your house today. Why? In Luke 19:10, because the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. It's a large, grand vision in Luke's gospel that Jesus willingly associates himself with. And in that light, it's not surprising that when Jesus is crucified, that the scene actually shows that while nobody around Jesus quite gets it, one of the lost gets it. Because he came to seek and to save that which was lost. And here is a narrative of someone who is lost, who has a breakthrough, a moment in which something is realized. So we'll look at what it is that he realized. We'll look at the statement itself. Particularly two words, the notion of today, which is important in Luke's gospel, and what paradise is, which would also be nice to know, since that's where this thief will find himself today with Jesus. But let's jump into the setting. If you go back just several verses in the setting, it says that Jesus is regarded as, in this setting, one who is mocked cruelly by those around him. Look just above verse 39 to verse 37. Someone read that aloud for us. If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. A phrase mocking with ridicule Jesus who hangs on the cross. You remember the other narrative? They wagged their heads and they taunted him. You said such wonderful and great things. Or you claim to be able to deliver others, now deliver yourself. It's part of the scene. Okay, envision the scene of Jesus on the cross in a very public place being mocked and everybody knowing what's going on at the time. And then if you didn't know, the very next verse, verse 38 says, there was an inscription over him saying, this is King of the Jews. And it's probably not to be read as a sincere statement of appreciation for Jesus' true identity, but rather as the public charge against him. This dummy had the audacity, or this man had the foolishness to be able to claim that he was king of the Jews. Now, by the way, if you were a Roman and claiming to be king of the Jews, that's like, you know, me claiming to be the best of the ditch diggers or something. It's not exactly a claim to prominence. It's not a statement of pride. It's a statement that, you know, you can have them. You want to be king of the Jews? Fine. I'll be king of the ants. You can be king of the aardvarks. It doesn't matter. There's very little there that motivates you to be appreciated. So even the statement, this is king of the Jews, is probably to be read as a statement of some mocking, or at least some ridicule towards Jesus. And then he says, in light of the contrasting opinions, there is a breakthrough moment. Tell me what the man realizes. The man who realizes in the midst of this experience of crucifixion, with Jesus in the center, one on each side of Jesus, what does this one realize? He realizes something about Jesus in light of this crucifixion. Jesus doesn't belong on the cross because of his life. So there's that admission. Modestly, it could be simply he's not worthy of a charge or guilty of a charge that would require crucifixion. In the least sense, it could be that he didn't do something that was worthy of crucifixion under the practice of everyday law. Now, most of us would say, well, neither did these guys, because they were simply thieves or criminals. But no, the admission is by the thief. The second thing is, they deserve it. Yes, Rosemary's exactly right. They deserve, under the practice of everyday law, they deserve it. Now, that's the minimal sense, that Jesus is not guilty of a crime for which this is the punishment. Now, there's a larger sense that most of us tend to read this statement in, and that is, the more impressive, the more pious, the more religious sense, not simply that he didn't do this crime or a crime that got him this, but go back. No, it's about the crime itself. We usually read this as a religious portrait, sort of a theological picture. Not just that he didn't do an act specifically assigned to the outcome of death on the cross, but he's sinless. He didn't do anything wrong in the general sense, in the larger sense. There is a breakthrough moment, and there's a struggle to try to figure out how much this man knew. Did this man know that Jesus didn't deserve to be crucified today, but maybe if he did something wrong, he'd be crucified tomorrow justly, in the minimal sense? Or did he realize the larger question of, this guy never did anything wrong, this obviously should never happen to this person? You see, most of us, when you read the narrative, although you can sort of spiritualize it and say, this man was on the right road, he's not quite to the statement that most of us are familiar with, that is, he did no sin. In the larger sense, just making a generalization about Jesus' life, which becomes the generalization that Christians confessionally speak of. He was made like us in all things except sin, the confession teaches Christians to say. Or as the author of Hebrews says, he was tempted in all ways as we are, yet without sin. See, we make generalizations about the character of Jesus in his entire life. This man is probably just making that first step. In light of this circumstance, he doesn't belong here, but we do. But it's a step which is, this is part of figuring out what it is that is so right about what this man said, what his breakthrough moment is. Yes. Part of, and that's the next phase of this, what does he understand? He realizes Jesus doesn't deserve this circumstance of death. There's something that gives you an indication that he also sees something else going on in Jesus. He asks Jesus to, okay, what else could he ask for? Get me out of this place, right. Maybe, which means what? He didn't make the request, get me out of here. He didn't say, when you get down from the cross, please get me down from the cross. He, in a sense, he assumes that they will both die. Alright, now, so we're trying to figure out what it is that he knows. Ah, now that's when we get to the phrase of paradise and what paradise is taken to mean, or what paradise is commonly used to describe. There's something about it. Remember, when you come to the kingdom, there's a royal emphasis. There's a rule, there's an outcome to somebody who is ruled. We'll see that in a moment. But he's beginning to see something. Jesus doesn't belong here now. He is this royal figure. He could have asked for what? He could have said, get me out of here. He could have said, come on, think for a moment. What do we usually associate with conversion experiences? We usually say, forgive my sins. Or we usually say, save me from this. Now, save me could be physically, or it could be spiritually, in the sense of deliver me from the consequences of my sins. And now we're going down the road which says that for you to act in an appropriate way toward me would bring about pardon for my sins. Now, there is some implication. What would make you think that at least he realizes, in light of his circumstances and Jesus' circumstances, that pardon might be part of the story? Well, that's why I said a moment ago that I think most people around the cross of Jesus knew what was going on. They heard the story of Jesus. Remember the people walking by? Oh, he talked about saving others. Let him save himself. He raised the dead. Let him take care of himself. It's as if people talking about, you ever milled about in the crowd not knowing what was there, and after a couple minutes you heard reports in the stories of the crowd, why are we standing here, what's going on? Have you ever been to an accident scene where you're just walking along and within 5 minutes you figure out who was shot or who ran into whom or what was happening because of the word of mouth being passed around in the crowd? Even if you didn't know anything about Jesus, it's probably the case that within a couple minutes you would have been clued in because of the reports of the crowd. Maybe you would have heard a report from somebody saying, this guy walked around and did great miracles. Maybe he's going to do a miracle now. Or somebody else walking around saying, this is the guy that raised that other guy from the dead. Let's see what he's going to do in light of his own death. Maybe somebody else walking around would say, oh, he was a great teacher. Maybe we'll listen to his dying words. And he was going to say something profound. Somebody else could have said he was a prophet. He quoted Elijah. Remember what happened to Elijah? He didn't die. He was spirited away on chariots of fire. Let's see if chariots of fire come from this guy. And so people looking around, waiting for chariots of fire to swoop down and rescue him off the cross. The report of the crowd could have been all of this. And little parts of the story here, reports about Jesus. And then other people walking by would have seen the sign across on top of the cross saying, this is King of the Jews. If you were a Roman, that would make you laugh. If you were a Jew, you might be incensed. He's not King of the Jews. Sort of like somebody who feels that George Bush is the selected rather than the elected president. It's sort of mocking and ridicule if you're a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat to say he's the selected president, not the elected president. He's not my president, or he's not the popular president. It's sort of the ridicule that you would have, that kind of ridicule. The Jews would have said, he's not my king. Apart from the words that he said. He got a track along with it. I don't doubt it. That's part of the point. There are a lot of people around Jerusalem who know. What has Jesus done? The crowds welcomed him a week before this and cried out, Hosanna, this is the Son of David. There was a popular uprising. He went into the temple and he crashed it. Believe me, everybody knew in Jerusalem that Jesus had crashed the temple. That he was secretively hidden away. Where did he go? Was part of probably public knowledge at the time. These are all fair assumptions. Some of them are explicit in the biblical text. It's not that people don't know what's going on. They do know what's going on, and there's a myriad of opinions. But this man's breakthrough opinion says, Jesus doesn't deserve this. We, to the other thief, deserve this. And there's a third thing he does. He tries to stop the other thief from mocking and ridiculing Jesus. He has, what would you call that? Where he not only talks to Jesus, but he also talks to, remember his statement, to this man has done nothing wrong, but we have done something wrong, is not spoken to Jesus. It's spoken to the other criminal. What does that represent? What does it speak? Yes, he has this sort of He has that, he has this maybe assault of conscience, which would have been rare for this man. There is something that shows what's going on. He's not just talking to Jesus. He's not ignoring. He's aware of the circumstances. What else is going on in what he says? And we're getting closer to what Dick was saying. What does he actually say? Verse 42. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now, the assumption of resurrection is the most common assumption, that when you come into your kingdom speaks of resurrection. Now, there's two things that complicate it, one in the text and one in the background. One in the text is, Jesus says, today you'll be with me in paradise. Unless he means today in a very figurative sense, it can't be today because the resurrection is still a couple days away. Second element that complicates it is how people use the word paradise. But it is, what he sees about Jesus is that Jesus is going to come into something. Something is appropriate for Jesus to experience, and the cross and its death is not appropriate, or it's not fitting to his character or his deeds, or at least his deeds in this sense. He has not done something worthy of this. That's the man's confession that he says to the other man on the cross. So he's showing that he's aware of something that's contrary in Jesus' experience. And then he addresses Jesus and says, Jesus, name, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now, Jesus interprets this as, Jesus goes from there, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He doesn't say, no, I'm not talking about my kingdom, I'm talking about paradise. He builds on the phrase or jumps off the phrase and says, today, or verily, truthfully, today you will be with me in paradise. Okay, let's look at two things, the word today and the word paradise. First of all, the way the word today is used. I want you to turn back in your Bibles in Luke and look at Luke 13, 32 and 33. Luke 13, 32 and 33. And when somebody is there, you can read it aloud for us. Okay. Here is the warning of some Pharisees who came to Jesus and warned Jesus to get out of this region, for Herod wants to kill you. And Jesus responds with insults and mocking, ridicule, and then some more insults about a prophet can't be killed outside. A prophet of God, the God of Jerusalem, can't be killed outside of Jerusalem. It's this mocking, dripping sarcasm of who kills the prophets of God, that is, the people of God in the city of God. But also there is this warning from some Pharisees who say, hey, Herod's going to plan to kill you. And Jesus says, you know, I got work to do. I can't be bothered with this. You go tell him. And it's not like, it's not a compliment to call him a fox in this setting, okay? It's, you tell him that deceitful, thieving, treacherous one, that would be the reference to fox. He says, I've got things to do today and tomorrow, and I'll finish my work on the third day. There is within this text, as well as, for example, earlier in the announcement to the shepherds, today in the city of David is born unto you a Savior who is Christ the Lord. Luke tends to use the phrase of days, times, like today or tomorrow, in a way that those who read this text in form of literature would say that he means to emphasize not simply that it's today as opposed to tomorrow, but it's in the present time, or it's at the present time that this will happen. Usually we, especially when you deal with children, they say, well, when are we going to go on vacation? And you say, we're going to go today. And they're like, woohoo! You say tomorrow, it's like, oh, tomorrow is forever away. Today for us usually means today, not tomorrow. But today in Luke's gospel tends to mean in the present time. It tends to be a figure of speech. If you go to the narrative in Luke 19, in which Jesus goes to the house of Zacchaeus, you hear the same thing again. In verse 5 of Luke 19, somebody who finds their way there can read that aloud for us. Luke 19:5. I must stay at your house today. And then again in verse 9, Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house. In Luke's gospel, Jesus shows up, provides this miraculous word of salvation, usually in a setting, in this notion that he is there today to accomplish this. Or words like, today these words are fulfilled in your hearing, which he said in Luke 4 after reading from the prophet. Jesus wants to communicate, it seems, that he is present today to provide this gift, this outpouring of salvation. The announcement of salvation is associated with today. It's probably the same way the prophet and later the apostle Paul took up this notion in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2. Now is the acceptable time. Now or today is the day of salvation. It's not simply today, Sunday, as opposed to Monday or Saturday, but rather this time is the announcement of salvation in this setting. So in Luke 23, when Jesus says, today you'll be with me in paradise, it might not simply mean today, the day I'm dying, but it might mean in this time or associated with this announcement, you will not be hindered from enjoying what it is that I say you're about to experience. But it doesn't mean necessarily this instant or in this 24-hour period of time as opposed to that, which may open things up a little bit and say that he doesn't mean simply Friday before sunset, but rather in light of the larger announcement of salvation, you will experience paradise. Yes, and that's the announcement is today. The problem is that characteristically in Luke's gospel, the phrase today is so grammatically it tends to be associated with the exclamation itself, not the setting of the exclamation. It tends to be the pattern. That is, if the pattern holds true, then this would be fitting. If there's an exception, it's simply a description. Mark's gospel uses phrases that have to do with time. And so Jesus right away went and did this. And you read Mark's gospel and he has all of these conjunctions to say, and immediately and right away. And Mark is much more concerned. You read Mark's gospel and you run out of breath after three chapters. Because Jesus is rushing everywhere. In Luke's gospel, the association of time usually has to do with the setting in which, not simply today as opposed to tomorrow, but in the literary setting, this period of time. There's another thing that helps us understand the statement, and that is the word paradise, paradisio. It's used two other places in the New Testament. Paul, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, in describing his being caught up into the heavens to have this great vision, talks about unspeakable things that he saw in paradise. And then a second phrase in Revelation chapter 2, verse 7. You can turn there, because this one is right on track. Paul envisions in 2 Corinthians 12 there is a place called paradise that he is spirited away to, and he sees things that simply cannot be spoken of. It is a place that you could literally say makes him speechless. Not simply that he could say it, but I'm not going to share the secret with you. What he means in 2 Corinthians is probably, I don't have words to speak of the glory of this paradisio, this place of paradise. Why would it be so overwhelming? Why is it, does he know and is not telling us? No. He doesn't have words to talk about it. It is such a glorious, overwhelming, awe-inspiring place. It makes him speechless. And then in the letter to the message of the church in Ephesus, in verse 7, someone want to read that aloud for us? Verse 7, the last of this statement is to the church in Ephesus. Okay, what's that referring to? I will give permission to eat from the tree of life that is in the paradise of God. It's a big story. Garden of Eden. Tell me the story. Why the tree of life? What's the tree of life? In the garden narrative on chapter 2 and 3, there's a tree of life and there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Their eyes were open. They knew they were naked. They had offended God. They had disobeyed his word. They followed the advice of the serpent. There was consequences for them. And then God says something about the tree of life. We have to keep them from eating the tree of life and living forever in the state of the knowledge of good and evil. So, he drives them out of the garden. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the word used to describe garden is paradisia. Paradise. That's the word in the Septuagint chosen to translate the phrase. It's probably taken from an old Persian usage of the place. Paradise is a specific place and doesn't refer to the place, but refers to what is groomed or put in the place, like a planter or Buckingham Fountain in a park. The paradise is a place in which you are concerned not about the setting, but about what's in the setting. That's what makes it paradise. Paradise is like a royal court in which the king's rose garden grows. It's a place in which there are great planters. The paradise in Old Persian tends to be a place in which it's a royal place in which kings move about freely, but others are restricted from. You cannot go there. Unless you are royalty, you don't go there. Paradise, as the old Persians, was a place in which only royalty would go. The Garden of Eden is a place in which the tree of life is found. Human beings are driven from the garden lest they eat from the tree of life. They are forever forbidden until the end of the book of Revelation, in which it is promised here that they will experience something that Revelation speaks of. The tree of life is there. The nations, or the people, will eat from it. It yields fruit in all 12 months, and the fruit of the tree is for the healing of the nations. My favorite phrase in the book of Revelation. The fruit of the tree is for the healing of the nations. The paradise of God. Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 31, verse 8, talks about a time in which God will make a wilderness. Remember the valley of dry bones? God will make a valley place wilderness into the paradise of God like Eden. What is paradise? It is the royal court. It is the place where somebody who is a king and somebody who will experience the favor of God. Isaiah 51, verse 3, talks about how God will restore the fortunes of Jerusalem, restore the fortunes of Judah, will transform the wilderness into a place in which it will be even better than the Garden of Eden. You say, better than the Garden of Eden? Better than the Garden of Eden. It'll be the paradise of God, the Garden of Eden restored. Remember, Eden is a forbidden place for everyone after the because of the consequence of Adam and Eve's activity. In Revelation, Jesus promises something. There is a royal association. You may enter paradise. You may re-enter the Garden of Eden and walk about in the place of royalty, the place of blessing, the place of richness, the place in which life rather than death is found. You can walk about and eat from the tree of life, and you will live. Today you will be with me in paradise. The royal garden place of life. The rich tree, the promise of Jesus to the thief. Probably not simply that you're going to get out of this. It's probably this admission. The thief thinks of Jesus as the royal inheritor of the garden. Probably not in the larger sense of, well, I was reading the Septuagint and I noticed that paradisio is the translation. Probably in this sense. Probably in that he sees Jesus as the royal figure. It's probably not that he figures it all out. He sees Jesus as not deserving these circumstances. But he sees himself as deserving the circumstances. He has this pang of conscience. He knows something is different. He also knows that he associates with Jesus this message of a kingdom. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. When Jesus speaks in the Gospels and he wants to make the larger, grander promises about what it is to explain what's going on, he usually uses the allusion to the notion or the phrase kingdom. The third thing is he probably sees that Jesus not only does not belong on the cross, but belongs in the paradise of God. There's a fourth element, and that is that when others speak in this time frame of the death of someone who is large and impressive, if you are a great hero, if you are a martyr, if you are a military leader, if you are a royal official, when you die in your death narrative, if you are being narrated or biographed by somebody, where do you go when you die? In Roman literature, you go to a garden. Paradise. If you are somebody who is despicable, you go to Hades. That is the place where the god Hades rules, the netherworld. In Roman literature, if you die and you don't deserve anything good, you are sent to Hades. Luke's Gospel, chapter 16, Jesus, in telling a parable, a story about Lazarus and the rich man, uses the explicit reference, the expectation of, one, the bosom of Abraham, the place of rest and recline, in contrast to Hades, the place of torment and constant thirst, the dry place, the wilderness place, in which there is no refreshment. It is not a paradise. It is not a garden with flowing fountains. It is a place in which you are parched and tormented. And there is a gulf fixed between them. One cannot pass from one to the other. There is an appropriate place, paradise. There is an appropriate place for those who are criminals, Hades. And in the Roman setting, if you died and you were a martyr, if you were a hero of Rome, if you were a great leader, if you were a military hero, if you were a royal official, you would be expected to go to paradise. So this man says, remember me when you come into your kingdom, and Jesus says, today you will be with me in my paradise. Vision is that Jesus rightfully or will belong in this place. So what have we got Jesus saying? When Jesus says to the man, today you will be with me in paradise, what has he told him? Oh, who knows what I'm thinking? Yes. Yeah, there is this notion that a criminal who deserves this punishment will he appeals to the pardon. He asks for, let's use a political term, clemency. Not clemency in terms of his crucifixion, someone who is sitting on death row and experiences an act of clemency, but clemency in this spiritual dynamic of when you come into your kingdom, grant me clemency. Let me eat from the tree of life, that is, from the garden. Let me rest in the garden place with you. Jesus could have said, no, or you don't believe, or you don't understand enough, or you don't deserve it. But in Luke's Gospel, paradise is the place for those who are with Jesus. In Luke's Gospel, sinners and the lost are with Jesus. In Luke's Gospel, even at the moment of his death, Jesus grants forgiveness and pardon. We need to close off. We need to end our time today. We've exhausted our time. Yes, go ahead. That's all right. We got 24 seconds. I'm waiting. The question about whether or not there is a sense of another place like this place, you have to go much beyond this text to say that it's simply this place, it's one another place as opposed to this place. It is certainly set in contrast to the present experience of the place of crucifixion. And it is a place in which, well, nobody in this scene recognizes who Jesus is except this man who takes a baby step, as it were, and has the whole of the promises of God opened up to him because of that small, incipient little notion about something different about Jesus is here. Beyond that, that is this sort of where is it located, the figures of speech used, the third heavens by Paul to describe it, in the book of Revelation, the place which displaces this place and comes here, the images used for this, I think there are multiple images for the answer to the question, where is it exactly? And you have to go to Corinthians and Revelation to speak about it.
And I would suggest that that would be the place to go. All right.